hunting. Now back to Weekend Edition.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. Aisha Roscoe, good morning. Tucker Carlson's interview with a far-right influencer and white nationalist who promotes Holocaust denial has sparked an internal battle among conservatives.
I just want to make it really clear, I'm in the Hitler sucks wing of the Republican Party.
We have details. And we fact-checked the Trump administration's claim that it's deported 500,000 undocumented immigrants. Plus, a new book argues 16th century nuns can teach us a lot about coping with modern life. It's Sunday, November 9th. News is next.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. Authorities in Lake of the Woods have recovered a boat involved in a fatal drowning last month. The sheriff's office reports in a news release it recovered the 26-foot aluminum flat-bottom jet boat on Wednesday in 24 feet of water in Lake of the Woods. Several divers and Towboat U.S. assisted in the recovery. On October 18th, 69-year-old Brian Harridge of Minnesota and 69-year-old Lori Bringelson of Colorado went into the water when the boat capsized. Both were transported by Lake of the Woods Ambulance Service to Lakewood Health Center in Baudette. Harridge was later pronounced dead, and Bringelson was treated for exposure. The water temperature was 48 degrees at the time. In time with the Minnesota firearms deer season opener, state and local law enforcement officials have a somber reminder for hunters heading out to their stands and cabins to keep an eye out for signs of missing people. The Beltrami County Sheriff's Office is asking hunters to watch for signs of 68-year-old Russell Coyle, who was last heard from in April when he made arrangements with a friend to watch his dog. He was last known to be at his Kellyer home and generally wears a beard with flannel shirts and blue jeans and always carries a player's holder on his belt. Authorities say to contact them immediately when encountering clothing in an unexpected or remote area where it does not belong and bones or remains that do not appear to be from animals. Assistance from the Federal Emergency Management Agency is available for the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe after this June's windstorm. Two FEMA disaster recovery centers will be open 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. through November 19th. One is at the Leech Lake Facility Center in Cass Lake, and the other is at the former First National Bank building in downtown Bemidji. Leech Lake band members and their descendants are eligible for individual assistance with the impacts of the storm that devastated the Bemidji area and the western portion of the reservation. FEMA offers funds for temporary housing, repairing or replacing owner-occupied homes, hazard mitigation assistance, and other uninsured or underinsured disaster-caused expenses. Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan made a campaign stop in Grand Rapids on Friday. Megan Buffington was there and has more.
Flanagan chatted with some 35 area residents at Brood Awakenings for an hour. The coffee talk was the first stop in a day of campaigning for U.S. Senate in the region. Paula is a speech pathologist in an area school and declined to share her last name. She told Flanagan that teachers can't afford their health insurance plans. At every table, Flanagan says she heard about affordability. It's an issue that helped fuel Democratic victories in Tuesday's election and one she plans to lean into with her campaign. Flanagan will have to convince conservatives and her own party of her plans for universal health care and banning corporate money in elections. Moderate Democratic Congresswoman Angie Craig is also running to fill Senator Tina Smith's seat. Smith announced her retirement in February. How does Flanagan plan to make up the ground that her party has lost in rural northern Minnesota? By just showing up.
Just meeting people where they're at, not expecting folks to always come to us. And that's how I think we rebuild trust with people and how we win elections.
After Grand Rapids, Flanagan was heading up the Iron Range for more conversation, a mine visit, and a food shelf tour.
Northern Minnesota teams saw mixed success in this week's state tourneys. Megan Buffington is back with an update.
Grand Rapids dominated Benilde St. Margaret's in the first round of the 3A football bracket Thursday night. The Thunderhawks won 54-7, led by junior Mason Johnson's four touchdowns in the first half. They'll play Casson Manorville at the bank next Friday. Kitson County Central and Fertile Beltrami emerged victorious in the nine-player Northland matchups. The Bearcats totaled 49 points and shut out Cook County. The Falcons beat Cromwell Wright 40-14. The state title holders will have another rematch Thursday when they play 2024 runner-up Hills Beaver Creek in the semifinals. Immediately after that game, Kitson County Central will take to the field and face Hillcrest Lutheran Academy. Our region's only 2A qualifier, Moose Lake Willow River, ended their season Thursday with a 30-14 loss to Eden Valley Watkins. Megan Buffington, KAXE News.
That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
In addition from NPR News, I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. There's been a bit of a fallout in the last week after right-wing commentator Tucker Carlson's long and friendly interview with far-right influencer Nick Fuentes.
Nick Fuentes, thank you for doing this.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I wanted to meet you. I've heard about you.
I've heard about you.
So, well, thank you.
Fuentes has built an online following promoting many white nationalist and extremist ideas, including Holocaust denial. He's also used violent and degrading rhetoric about women. And a heads up, you'll hear an example of that in this story. As NPR's Sarah McCammon reports, prominent conservatives are now wrestling with how to respond to anti-Semitism in their ranks.
Nick Fuentes has suggested that a lot of women want to be raped, claimed that Jim Crow segregation laws were better for Black Americans, and expressed admiration for Hitler, among other things. Those kinds of statements have mostly kept Fuentes on the fringes of the conservative movement, but in an episode of The Tucker Carlson Show published on October 27th, Carlson sat down with Fuentes for a friendly conversation that lasted more than 2 hours. In one exchange, Fuentes invoked an old anti-Semitic trope, suggesting that Jewish loyalty to Israel and other Jews is standing in the way of a unified American society.
I would say, though, that the main challenge to that, a big challenge to that, is organized Jewry in America.
Fuentes then listed several influential Jewish Americans that he claimed were not capable of fostering national unity.
I see Jewishness as the common denominator. And you're
within
right.
Days, the interview sparked a backlash among some on the right.
But I just want to make it really clear, I'm in the Hitler sucks wing of the Republican Party.
That's South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham at the Republican Jewish Coalition meeting in Las Vegas last weekend, where several speakers called out rising anti-Semitism. But another prominent conservative, Kevin Roberts, the head of the influential think tank The Heritage Foundation, defended Tucker Carlson.
Who remains, and as I have said before, always will be a close friend of The Heritage Foundation. The venomous coalition attacking him are sowing division. Their attempt to cancel him will fail.
In that video posted to X on October 30th, Roberts also said conservatives should feel free to critique Israel despite pressure from what he described as the globalist class. That sparked backlash from some Heritage staff and allies, including Rabbi Yaakov Menken with the Coalition for Jewish Values.
Obviously, if you want to deride the UN as a collection of globalists, that's fine. But if you want to refer to unnamed globalists protesting against anti-Semitism, who do I imagine that's talking about?
Menken was part of a task force Heritage convened to fight anti-Semitism. Several members, including Menken's organization, ultimately stepped down from the task force in response to Roberts' handling of the situation. On Wednesday, Roberts met with Heritage staff to address the ongoing fallout.
I didn't
know much about this Fuentes guy. I still don't, which underscores the mistake.
In a video of the meeting published online, senior research fellow Robert Rector said conservatives should learn lessons from when the movement pushed out some of its most extreme voices.
You say, oh, we don't cancel. We do cancel. Did we cancel David Duke? Yes. Did we cancel the John Birch Society? Yes. Okay? Because they were harmful, because if they're in your movement, you look like clowns.
Rector said he was disturbed both by what he heard from Fuentes and by what he described as Tucker Carlson's failure to ask probing questions. Roberts responded to concerns from Rector and others with this.
That evil person, Fuentes, although I still have hope for his soul, has an audience of several million people. And at least some of that audience might be open to be converted.
That evening, Roberts released another video statement apologizing for his earlier choice of words and also referring to, quote, my friend Tucker Carlson. Shortly after, leaders of the Anti-Semitism Task Force announced they were disaffiliating from Heritage. For his part, Carlson sat down for an interview Thursday with Megyn Kelly, another former Fox News host turned podcaster. Kelly rattled off what she described as a long list of very vile past statements from Fuentes.
So what do you say to those people? Say, why didn't you raise any of that?
You know, do your own interview the way that you want to do it. You're not my editor. Buzz off. I mean, I don't know. You want to go yell at Nick Fuentes? I'll give you a cell. Call him. And go sit and yell at him and feel virtuous or whatever.
And Sarah McCammon joins us now. So you laid out what's happened in the last couple of weeks. But this isn't the first time that Republicans have had this fight, right?
Right. President Trump's critics point to a long history of actions and statements that they say have encouraged extremists. Like 3 years ago, when after facing blowback for dining with Nick Fuentes at Mar-a-Lago in Florida, Trump said on Truth Social that he didn't know Fuentes before hosting him. More recently, Trump's choice of a nominee for the Office of Special Counsel, who had a history of sending white supremacist texts, also caused concern. That nominee withdrew. And Aisha, this comes after a scandal involving anti-Semitic and racist messages exchanged by some young Republicans.
This is all happening at a time when there are rising reports of anti-Semitic incidents and violence. What are you hearing from Jewish leaders about how this fits into that larger pattern?
There is a lot of concern about what they're hearing across the political spectrum. But when it comes to Trump, Sam Markstein with the Republican Jewish Coalition pointed to his support for Israel and called him the best friend that the Jewish community has ever had in the White House. Amy Spitalnik at the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, a progressive group, says this is coming to a head on the right because the optics are just so bad.
I appreciate the voices who are speaking out right now, but it needs to go hand in hand with the moral clarity and courage to name this normalization of anti-Semitism wherever it exists within their own party, just as each of us have an obligation to do it in whatever spaces and political arenas we operate in.
And she says she's concerned about anti-Semitism across the political spectrum. And if conservatives are truly committed to stamping it out within their ranks, she says they need to hold their movement accountable for the people that they put in leadership.
That's NPR's Sarah McCammon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Of all the existing homes sold this past year, only about 1 in 5 went to a first-time buyer. A new report shows people are waiting until they're much older to buy that first home than in past years. The report underscores how challenging it's become for young people to get a foothold in the costly housing market, as NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Eve Burdick and her husband Cale just celebrated their first wedding anniversary. They're both 30 years old and at the stage of life when they'd like to be shopping for their first home. In fact, Eve Burdick has been window shopping.
Oh my gosh, all the time. Are you kidding me? I am on Zillow. My mom sends me stuff pretty much multiple times a week.
But even though home prices in Minneapolis, where the couple lives, are below the national average, everything they look at is far above their price range or needs more fixing up than the couple could afford.
There is no feasible way that we could buy a house for $350,000 and then pull a home equity line of credit to drywall the basement.
Burdick says by the time her parents were her age, they'd already owned a home for several years. But in today's pricey market, that's uncommon. A new report from the National Association of Realtors says the average person buying their first home this past year was 40 years old, an all-time high. Deputy Chief Economist Jessica Lout says the association had to scrap the photo that was supposed to go on the cover of the report.
The original cover had a very cute young couple who was expecting, and I said, that's not going to work. We're not seeing young couples, unfortunately, so it didn't match.
Instead, the realtors went with a photo showing a couple near retirement age, more representative of today's average buyer. Lout says first-time buyers accounted for just 21% of home sales during this past year. That's a record low and about half the share of first-time buyers a generation ago.
It shows some real problems in the housing market that need to be addressed for young adults to be able to purchase what ends up being their biggest financial asset and to bring them into the housing ladder. We have work to do.
Part of the problem is that people who already own homes, often with much lower mortgage rates, are staying put longer, a record 11 years on average. That means fewer houses are available to new buyers, a situation Lous describes as gridlock. The overall shortage of homes is compounded by the high price of other necessities, which makes it hard for first-time buyers to save up a down payment. Many are also saddled with student or medical debt. Sasha Skelton's 34. Her partner's 36. She works in HR for a bank. He's in property management. Skelton wishes they'd been able to buy a home a few years ago when interest rates were lower, but they were repeatedly outbid, often by older, wealthier buyers. Today, she says, everything in their Richmond, Virginia suburb seems so expensive. She's also nervous about the job market and the overall economy.
It makes me cautious about really wanting to take a jump where if we have our jobs fall out from underneath of us, our house could be taken away. And like with the increase in groceries, it's just everything is kind of coming all at once, it feels like.
For now, Skelton and her partner have put house hunting on the back burner, but they haven't given up.
Both him and I moved around a lot. I was an army brat. So it would be nice to like settle down and have a home where we can like kind of put our roots in. It's just the market right now is not where we want it.
Mortgage rates have been inching down in recent months, but they're still more than twice as high as they were a few years ago. Meanwhile, the average home price just keeps going up. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News.
You are tuned in to Weekend Edition this Sunday morning here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. Donating stocks and mutual funds is a quick, easy way to defend KAXE from funding cuts. You may receive tax benefits as well. Call Sarah for details at 218-326-1234. Plans are underway for the 20th annual Back to Basics event on February 7th at Pine River Backus School. They are looking for presenters and vendors who are passionate about sustainable living. Proposals are due November 14th. Find more information at happydancingturtle.org. Stage North Theater presents 10 November, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, now through November 10th, at the Franklin Arts Center in Brainerd. Find showtimes and tickets at stagenorththeater.com. United Way of 1,000 Lakes presents Dining United, now through November 20th. Find a list of participating Itasca County restaurants at uwlakes.org.
I'm Giles Snyder with these headlines. Few signs of progress in breaking the government shutdown stalemate. The Senate is expected to meet again today after failing to reach a resolution yesterday. Flight delays and cancellations are piling up. According to the flight tracking website FlightAware, cancellations so far today top 1,200, and there are more than 1,300 delays as the Federal Aviation Administration limits air traffic at major airports around the country due to safety concerns. And President Trump is expected to be on hand this afternoon when the Washington Commanders play the Detroit Lions. Trump's attendance at the game comes as ESPN reported this weekend that Trump wants the Commanders' planned future stadium to bear his name. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunities for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. The Federal Aviation Administration says it will cut down flights by 10% across the U.S. as the government shutdown crept into its fifth week. It says the reason is safety. Fewer air traffic controllers are reporting for duty. Mechanical problems and weather aren't helping either. So what can you do to minimize travel headaches now and with the holidays coming up? Suzanne Rowan Kelleher covers travel for Forbes and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So over 1,000 flights have already been canceled. What's your number one tip for minimizing the odds of hitting flight delays?
I think it's until the shutdown ends, frankly, it's going to be incredibly messy. I have talked to aviation experts who have just said, look, if you can drive in 8 hours or less, drive. And I just saw a notification from Hertz. Hertz CEO just said that they are seeing a huge uptick in people wanting to rent cars in a one-way direction. So that tells you that a lot of people are making that choice. If you have to fly, I would say the most important thing is getting to the airport early. And also, if at all possible, get on that very first flight, because these disruptions tend to really amplify the longer the day goes on.
So you're saying the main piece of advice is get there early and fly very early in the morning. Is that the best time of the day?
Oh, yeah. First, if you can possibly, nobody wants to be on that, 6 a.m. flight, but they show that statistics show, and this is true anytime, like even if there was like a winter storm, if it, any kind of travel where you have to get there and you don't want to delay, flight cancellations and delays really start to amplify, and they kind of creep up like a domino effect as morning turns into afternoon and then afternoon turns into evening.
Well, now in a piece you wrote last week, you recommended that people get to the airport super early. Now, when you say early, how early and why?
Well, there's a couple of things going on. Early as possible, like if you can get there at 7 o'clock, if you can book that 7 a.m. flight, do that. I know it's very inconvenient, but you're reducing your risk of a disruption by, exponentially.
And should we get that? If we make the 7 a.m. flight, should we be there like 2 hours ahead of time? Like, does it matter when you arrive at the airport?
It does during the shutdown. In the morning, things tend to be a little bit quieter, but TSA, remember, the TSA workers are also not getting paid during the shutdown, and they're seeing a lot of sick calls and people not coming into work as well. And though, last week, Houston had to shut down three of the five airport security lines, and other airports have had to do that too. So I think obviously when that happens, every other line gets a lot longer. So if you don't get there early enough, you risk maybe missing your flight.
So I mean, all of these travel disruptions are happening before the holidays are here. How bad do you think things will get closer to Thanksgiving week?
I mean, it all depends what happens with the shutdown. If it ends, even if it ends before Thanksgiving, there's still going to be kind of a hangover from this, because the aviation system can't just flip a switch and everything go back, kind of to normal. So it, I do anticipate that there's going to be some disruption even going into Thanksgiving, but hopefully not as bad as what we're seeing right now.
That's Forbes reporter Suzanne Rowan Kelleher. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Trump administration continues its aggressive campaign to detain and deport immigrants in the U.S. illegally. Multiple cities are at the center of these efforts, including Chicago and Los Angeles. Now the Department of Homeland Security says the crackdown, which started shortly after President Trump took office, has resulted in the removal of more than 500,000 undocumented immigrants so far. To fact-check these numbers and put them in context, we're joined now by NPR's Sergio Martinez-Beltran. Welcome, Sergio.
Hi, Aisha.
So where does that figure, 500,000 people deported, come from? And is it accurate?
Well, the pace of deportations has clearly increased by a lot under Trump, but it's not clear that this 500,000 figure is accurate. This number comes from a DHS-issued press release, but it did not provide any evidence or additional information. Now, NPR repeatedly requested data from DHS to support that claim, and they have not yet responded.
Is it unusual for administrations to have this kind of lack of transparency on immigration figures?
So administrations typically provide some evidence to back their deportation numbers, even if it's just annually. Look, ICE collects a lot of data on every person it arrests, detains, transports, and deports. But this administration is not releasing all of that information. They have released some detention numbers that show people at a given time in immigration facilities, but they have not released a breakdown of deportation numbers. I talked to Dara Lind with the American Immigration Council, a nonprofit advocacy group. She has compared these latest DHS deportation numbers to data obtained through the Freedom of Information Act by the Deportation Data Project at UC Berkeley and UCLA. That data she looked at is through June, and Lynn says there is a significant gap.
They definitely are engaging in more removals in the data that we have toward the end of that period than at the beginning. We're still looking at fewer than 7,500 removals a week. That's a lot of people. It's a lot of people. But it's nowhere near the number that you would need to have gotten to 500,000.
Even if they have kept up that high rate of 7,500 deportations a week, that would have totaled 300,000 in the first 10 months of this administration. And as Lynn says, that's way short of its aggressive goal of deporting 1 million undocumented immigrants every year. The administration also says that more than 1.6 million undocumented immigrants have left the country on their own this year. But again, they have not provided any data to back that up.
The Trump administration regularly claims that the vast majority of those detained, 70%, are criminals charged with or convicted of a crime in the U.S. Here's DHS spokesperson Tricia McLaughlin recently on Fox News.
We have 10,000 new ICE enforcement officers that are going to be hired in the coming days. So we know that we're going to continue to arrest the worst of the worst off of the streets of America's sanctuary cities and across the nation.
So, Sergio, worst of the worst, 70% criminals. Is this accurate?
No, not really, Aisha. According to DHS's own detention data, 53% of immigration detainees had either pending charges or a conviction. The rest had no criminal record. And it's important to note that the 53% includes violations like property theft and traffic violations. One report in June from the libertarian think tank, the Cato Institute, found that only about 7% of the people booked by ICE had serious or violent convictions. The other 93% either did not have a violent conviction or any convictions at all. Here's Tara Lind again with the American Immigration Council.
They don't see a particularly strong difference between people who have committed very serious crimes and people who have no contact with the criminal justice system whatsoever, but who are in the U.S. without documentation.
For context, two things to keep in mind here. First, entering the country illegally, coming in without documentation, is often a misdemeanor. And once in the U.S., if a migrant gets picked up without papers, that is often a civil offense.
That's NPR's Sergio Martinez-Beltran. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Americans are familiar with culture wars around public health. India has its culture wars too, including one in Mumbai over feeding birds, specifically pigeons. Omkar Khandakar has this report from the Indian port city.
For nearly 40 years, Mumbai residents Premlata Soni and her husband start their day feeding pigeons who gather by a heavily polluted bright green pond near their home. Sometimes it's a few fistfuls of corn and millet grain. Sometimes it's an entire bag. Soni says even through pandemic lockdowns, they would sneak out to feed the birds. She sees it as her religious duty. She says God wants her to do it. God may want it, but Mumbai's authorities do not. For years, they have tried to battle what they see as the scourge of pigeons, a bird that has done very well in a city of skyscrapers by nesting in apartment ducts and near air conditioning units. So in July, the city banned pigeon feeding in public spaces. Authorities covered feeding spots with blue tarpaulin sheets. Then they put up posters warning of respiratory illnesses from pigeon feathers and poop. That did not stop Soni. She says the birds will have nowhere to go if no one feeds them. Vikram Khan guards the pond. He says he sees dozens like her defy the ban every day, but he doesn't interfere. Because the last time he did, he got punched in the face. Feelings run high about pigeons in multi-faith Mumbai, in part because for some communities, feeding them is a religious duty, especially for the Jain community, which abhors harming any living creature. Local politician Puran Doshi is one of them.
I'm a Jain, and let me give you a little bit of background.
Doshi says, according to Jain scriptures, one of their gods gave his life to protect a pigeon from a falcon. Jain started feeding pigeons to honor that sacrifice. And decades ago, Mumbai's authorities helped out too by marking out pigeon feeding spaces called Kabutar Khanas. After the ban was announced in July, hundreds of Jains protested outside one popular Kabutar Khana and tore up the barriers. That ticked off another group of Mumbai residents, the majority Maharashtrians, some of whom have long resented the power and influence that Jains have enjoyed in the city. Jains are perceived as dominant in the diamond trade and the financial district. One Maharashtrian group accused them of trying to impose their cultural values. Days later, they staged their own protest against pigeons and Jains. The pigeon culture war despairs ornithologist Mohammad Dilawar. He says the real problem is there are just too many pigeons, and that's because people are feeding them.
This is called as a human-induced population. It's not a natural population.
And this human-induced population, he says, is also a public health concern. Vaishali Chodnekar's husband died a few years ago after he was diagnosed with irreversible lung damage. She says the doctor said it was likely because of the pigeons nesting in their terraced apartment.
So he said that pigeons have some problems in their droppings, like they have some microorganisms which cause irreversible lung damage.
Today, Vaishali runs a foundation to help others with lung diseases. She says of the 250 people they had helped get a lung transplant so far, more than three-fourths had unhealthy exposure to pigeon feces.
In India, any issue comes up, politicians and religions has to happen. But the main concern and focus should be on the health of the people.
But the tensions over pigeons are not always about just religion or health. Pinku Kumar Goswami came from a small village to find his fortunes in Mumbai. He now spends his nights collecting plastic and glass bottles to sell to recyclers. It's a lonely job, but he has found some who keep him company. Dogs, cats and pigeons. He says if you feed them, pigeons recognize you. They will even come and sit on your shoulder. In a big city, he says, it's a way to feel at home. Omkar Khandekar, NPR News, Mumbai. Thank you.
listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Some SNAP recipients have been seeing payments again, though the Trump administration is appealing a court order to fully restart the program amid the government shutdown. About 42 million Americans rely on SNAP. For many of them, the uncertainty of whether they would get any funds last week forced them to turn to food pantries for help for the first time. Adam Wagner with the North Carolina Newsroom has this report from a food pantry in Tarboro.
A little more than an hour east of Raleigh, Tarboro is in Edgecombe County. About 30% of its nearly 50,000 residents receive SNAP benefits. With funding for SNAP in limbo, the need has been especially obvious at Tarboro Community Outreach. The center houses the county's largest food pantry, which feeds at least 6,000 people each month.
Deli meat.
People start lining up around 11:30 each morning. If they're familiar with the system, they take a number. If they are first-timers, they sign up for a card that lets the local food bank track their visits across pantries. There are about 20 new people today. They all get a grocery cart.
Help yourself.
Pantry workers were worried they didn't have enough food donations for everyone waiting. Manager Phyllis Parisher announced a truck with more food would be arriving the next day.
You're not supposed to shop twice a week simply because of the food shortage. But since I'm having this truck and I notice not a lot of food there, I'm telling you, you can come back tomorrow.
Then, Parisher started calling numbers.
Seven.
People walked past tables lined with whatever the food bank had gathered. There was spinach, deli meat, potato salad, pre-prepared fruits, and vegetables from a local grocery store. Near the end of the line, everyone was allowed to pick one sweet from an assortment that included donut holes, cherry pies, and a few cakes. The very last stop was a rack with canned goods, where a worker tossed in however many cans of corn, beans, or spinach someone requested. Trinity Holloman lives with her grandfather. They typically receive about $150 in SNAP benefits each month. Holloman says SNAP's uncertainty caused her to panic, including pushing her to visit food pantries more frequently.
It's like you honestly have no idea what's going to happen. You don't know if you're going to get anything. You don't know if you're going to get the half. And if you don't get anything, it's like looking at what are you going to do? How are you going to make it to the next day?
One of the people signing up for a new food bank card was Tamika Whitaker. She usually receives about $200 in SNAP benefits to feed herself and four sons, ages 16 through 21. Whitaker is a certified nursing assistant and is picking up more hours at work to try to meet expenses.
That's the only way. And they need less time at home, a lot of less time at home, because I got to pick up extra shifts to cover the bills and the food.
The tables were bare by the time Whitaker arrived, but workers gathered enough food to give her a box. With inflation still on the rise, pantry organizers say more people have been seeking food relief in recent months. If supplies continue to dwindle, they say their food pantry could instead become a soup kitchen, offering at least one hot meal per day. For NPR News, I'm Adam Wagner in Tarboro, North Carolina.
This is NPR News.
You are tuned in to Weekend Edition here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the Lake Country Journal, a lifestyle magazine since 1997, a local publication sharing stories from the heart of Minnesota about the places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. LakeCountryJournal.com. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources is looking for people to collect tree seeds and cones this fall and winter. Current high-demand species include jack pine, black spruce, and red pine. Visit mndnr.gov/seedcone for more information. Take part in a community read-in at the Bemidji Public Library from 5 to 6 p.m., Mondays in November. Gather to read, quietly together, demonstrate support, and celebrate the library. Now we'll take you back to Weekend Edition here on member-supported radio, KAXE-KBXE.
I'm Giles Snyder with these headlines. Nearly a million Filipinos have been evacuated from their homes as Super Typhoon Fung Wong lashes the country. The storm made landfall today with winds of 115 miles per hour. The storm is the second to hit the Philippines over the past week. A powerful earthquake rattled northern Japan today. It struck off the coast with a magnitude of 6.9. There are two nuclear plants in the area, but public broadcaster NHK says no abnormalities have been reported. And the mysterious fedora-wearing individual who sparked internet speculation when he was photographed on the day of the jewel heist at the Louvre has been identified by the AP. Turns out the sharply dressed 15-year-old lives with his parents just outside Paris and happened to be strolling by. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Modern life is full of pressure, deadlines, doom scrolling, dating apps. It can make you want to return to a simpler time, maybe a convent in 16th century Spain. A new book makes the case that even though nuns in the 1500s may not have had to deal with screens, they did have to grapple with frenemies, overbearing church officials, and shaky finances. In Convent Wisdom, scholars Ana Garriga and Carmen Urbita scour the writings of Renaissance-era nuns for nuggets of insights that can apply to current day dilemmas. Ana Garriga and Carmen Urbita join us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
You both have PhDs from Brown University. That's where you met. How did you both end up so fascinated with nuns? And let's start with you, Ana.
For me, it was because I was studying in Spain and I was focusing on early modern literature. And I was like, I want to read a woman that was able to publish in the 16th century, and the only option was Saint Teresa of Avila. So after that, I was truly fascinated by the way all these women were able to revolt and to write.
So it was the nuns, they were the ones who were able to publish, and that's how you got interested in them.
Yeah.
And Carmen, what about you?
I was studying at Oxford. I was doing my master's in literature. I still didn't know what I was going to do my PhD about, but I just came across this autobiography by a French nun called Joan d'Assange. She was possessed by many, many demons. And I was really shocked at how the fact that she wrote about it in a way that she made her demons her own.
She made the demons her own? What do you mean by that?
You know, we've all watched these mansplotation movies where you see demons possessing women in a very physical and very, you know, voyeuristic way. So I was fascinated to see this other side of possession. She talked about possession in her own terms. She talked about how these demons had to do with her own personality and her own traits. So I thought that was very, very interesting.
In the book, you point out that there weren't a lot of options for women back in this time. So why do you feel like the lives of these nuns in particular are relevant to today?
I mean, if you were a woman in the 16th or 17th century and you didn't want to get married and risk your life giving birth, probably you just wanted to join the convent to live with your friends or your family members, the female family members who already lived there. Or you were fascinated by the lives of the saints who were really famous at the time, and you just wanted to emulate them and try to achieve sainthood. There were many reasons why you wanted to join the convent, but one of them as well was that it was the only place where women at the time would have the time and the means to write about their own experience and to share that with other women. We've tried to recover this female archive, and continue to do what they were doing. Just recover these writings for the ones who are coming right after, and maybe we'll find some answers or at least a little bit of peace for the present. I don't know.
There is a funny passage where kind of using the 17th century nun Sor Juana as inspiration, you lay out 5 steps to writing an assertive, non-people-pleasing email. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, Carmen and me are like extremely people pleaser. One of the first seminars that we took at Brown was a seminar that was exclusively devoted to the writings of Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, that is probably like the most famous nun writer. She lived in 17th century Mexico. She was like a very atypical nun because she was an intellectual and she took part in the intellectual circles of her time. And she was a master of rhetoric. So she wrote this very famous letter. Basically, she had to find a way to revolt against her superiors, and she did it in a beautiful letter that was like a perfect maneuver without being like too rebellious.
It's like the sandwich technique. You say something that it's going to make your reader feel great, and then you say something terrible about yourself because you're so humble. And then, when they're not expecting it, you say what you really want to say, but in a very subtle way. And then you finish up with, again, you're being really laudatory and yes.
Let's not forget that Sor Juana ended up signing some of her letters as I, the worst of all. So,
okay. You know, a lot of the book also kind of catalogs the growing bond between the two of you. Were there any challenges or competition? Because, I mean, you guys are both studying like a very specific line of work.
Well, before meeting, I thought, we're going to hate each other. We were doing exactly the same thing.
I didn't want to tell that, but it's true.
I think we both thought, oh my God, who's this girl? We're going to hate each other. Something that we learned from our nuns is that the fact that these women had to live together for their whole lives made it harder to just get people out of their lives at the first difficulty. So we learned something of value there. There are better ways to try and work out things that may arise in any relationship, friendship, or any other kind of relationship.
And one of you was actually coming to terms with your own sexuality as you were doing this research. I mean, how did reading about these sort of repressed nuns help with that realization?
I mean, it was truly therapeutic, you know, it was life-changing in a way. I was married, then I got divorced during this time, and I came out of the closet. And it's hard to say that I realized, but yeah, in part, I already knew, but I had to face the truth.
It's very funny to think that early modern nuns helped
get
you
out,
get
of, out the of the closet. Yes. I mean, they can really change your life.
Yeah. That was Carmen Urbita and Ana Garriga. Their new book is Convent Wisdom, How 16th Century Nuns Could Save Your 21st Century Life. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us. It was great.
Thank you so much.
It's the circle of life, really the circle of love. Because just as there are rom-coms, there are breakup movies.
Peter, as you know, I love you very much.
Are you breaking up with me?
You just don't belong in my world, Bella.
I'm moving to San Francisco because I got my dream job, career girl over here, doing the damn thing.
Okay.
Getting it done,
okay.
You know?
Yeah,
and he just didn't want to do long distance.
Wow.
I know.
Really?
The good, the sad, the melodramatic. I mean, Bella, you're 17. Edward is 104. And girl, he's a vampire. But still, that heartbreak, it's relatable. Later today on All Things Considered, NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer, Stephen Thompson, and Mia Venkat discuss breakup movies.
I think it's pretty cathartic in that, like, when you're going through it already, to, like, watch someone else go through it and just get to be sad about it.
I think part of it is a certain amount of, like, it puts things in perspective. Like, as, you know, bad as this is, I'm not Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson in Marriage Story.
Break out the popcorn and listen on your radio, your phone, or your smart speaker. A brain in a jar rolls out of a dusty storage bin as work crews are clearing the archives of the Army Medical Museum in Washington, D.C.
Let's pick up the pace, fellas. Get all this stuff on out of here.
This is the opening scene of the new Netflix miniseries, Death by Lightning. And the label on that jar of brains, it reads Charles J. Guiteau.
Who the f*** is Charles Guiteau?
Oh, so you asked that question too. Well, let me fill you in. In 1881, Charles Guiteau shot President James A. Garfield, who was then just a few months in office. Garfield died several weeks later. Death by Lightning is about how the paths of these two men crossed with such devastating consequences. Matthew McFadden plays Charles Guiteau and joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Who was Charles Guiteau and why was he fixated on President Garfield?
Charles Guiteau was a man who, he was a sort of strange, sad, he wasn't terribly well. I guess now he would be diagnosed with a variety of, I don't know, mental health conditions. He had a difficult childhood, he had an abusive father, and he couldn't really hold down a job. He joined a sort of free love community called the Oneida community. He was kicked out of that. Nothing really worked.
Even the free love didn't work. That's sad.
I know. He wrote a pamphlet sort of supporting James Garfield and really believed that when he won the presidency, Guiteau had been key in getting him elected, of course. And he was sort of deluded. He suffered from, I think, delusions of grandeur and paranoia and all kinds of things. He thought he deserved a post in the administration.
I feel in my core that I really do know you. Mr. Garfield, I'm your man.
When he's thought of now, I mean, he's a bit of a footnote. As you said, I mean, people think of him as mentally ill. How did you approach playing him? What did you want to do with this role?
It was such a brilliant script. It was so beautifully written by Mike Mikowski. And Mike had his inspiration from Candice Millard's book, The Destiny of the Republic. I didn't know anything about that particular period of history, which was a delight to discover. You know, as an actor, you long for parts like that. It's a really delicious part to play. And I felt that he was weirdly sympathetic, Guiteau. I had the overriding sense that he wanted to belong, and mental illness notwithstanding, he wanted to be part of the group and he wanted to be valuable and be seen and all those things that we can relate to.
Would appear our bullet slid on past the first lumbar vertebra. It's launched itself further.
The way that doctors treated Garfield after the shooting and what led to his death, it was really awful.
Sir, this probe is damaging your patient and your equipment is not properly sanitized.
This is a critical moment. We can't waste time.
Forgive me, sir. Have you heard of the new research coming out of Europe on antisepsis?
We are not in Europe. Dr. Purvis, invisible monsters are a thing of superstition, not science.
They weren't, you know, washing their hands, and they were just putting their fingers in the wound, looking for that bullet.
And he must have unspeakable agony. Had they left him alone, he would have been okay.
Yeah, but they kept going in with those dirty fingers.
That's right. Wash your hands, people. I know.
Wash your hands. Yeah. And he was just 49 when he died. People don't think, though, about Garfield and Guiteau the way they think about, like, Lincoln and Booth. Why do you think this story has been so easily forgotten? I mean, it is a tragic story of a presidential assassination.
I think probably because I guess that period of history falls in between, you know, after the Civil War and before the beginning of the next century. And because Garfield didn't have time to do an awful lot, but he was a sort of charismatic and reluctant president who had a sort of moral intelligence and wanted to serve the American people and not himself. But I guess it's ultimately, even though it's a great shame that his presidency was cut short, it's a sort of hopeful story in that it's a good example of what decent leadership can look like, I suppose.
this is a reflection of a very sad part of American history, which is that political violence has been a part of American history, you know, basically since the beginning. Does Death by Lightning give any insights about political violence, about the aftermath, about the impact of it?
I guess the thing that comes across to me is that it's just the futility of it. There's no good thing that comes from any kind of violence that's committed in the name of a political party or a creed or whatever. And I'm sort of left with, you just feel the waste of it and the shame of missed opportunity.
So I have to ask you a quick unrelated question. Whatever happened to that marble bust of you from Pride and Prejudice? You know, the one that made Keira Knightley fall in love with you.
I don't know where. I've got one. So it's in an attic somewhere.
Okay, so you don't have it like in the bathroom?
No. It's not anywhere that I can see or anybody else can see. It's always that thing, isn't it, when people put their Oscars in the downstairs bathroom, which is actually the height of vanity because everyone goes in. So it's not, but not by design. I found it slightly creepy, and I sort of went into the back of a cupboard and then into an attic. So I haven't seen it for years. But there's also one in Chatsworth in this enormous big stately house where we shot parts of the film, which was Darcy's house in the movie, and it's there.
Okay.
And then there's a sign underneath it saying, do not kiss. Apparently. I haven't been.
But that's the thing. You have made a generation swoon. You've earned 2 Emmys for your role on Succession. And I understand you've also taken on the role of an iconic villain, he who must not be named, Lord Voldemort. This is for the new Audible Harry Potter series. Was that an intimidating job to take on?
I mean, Ralph Fiennes is sort of definitive in his portrayal of Voldemort. And so actually, when you do something like that, it's just quite nice to step into someone else's shoes. And also, it's not my face, it's just my voice. So it was a sort of 2 days in the studio and lots of fun and lots of sort of whispering evilly.
Can you do a little of the voice? Just a little.
I think I spent a lot of time whispering, Harry Potter. You know, lots of that.
Okay, Harry Potter.
Yeah, Harry Potter. It was a lot of fun. It was nice.
You must get recognized a lot because you've been in so many well-known roles. Like, how do you deal with it? And is there a certain type of person who recognizes you from a certain type of thing?
Sometimes in the States, it's a sort of bro thing with Succession.
Okay, yeah.
It's like seeing a kindred spirit, which is always slightly confusing. It's like, hey, Tom, way to go, you won. And then I'm always really flattered if people say, were you Mr. Darcy? Because that was a good 20 years ago. And so I think, God, I age hasn't withered me too badly yet.
That's Matthew McFadden, who stars in the new Netflix series, Death by Lightning. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Great pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com. From Legacy Box, working to preserve family memories by converting tapes and photos to digital, offering cloud delivery to enable access from anywhere. More at LegacyBox.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. Support comes from Boreal Brushworks Painting in Bemidji. Since 2009, Boreal Brushworks has provided full-service interior and exterior painting services throughout northern Minnesota. More information about estimates and services available at borealbrushworkspainting.com. November is Alzheimer's Awareness Month. If you are a caregiver of someone with this disease, the Alzheimer's Foundation of America